Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we might actually be approaching the end of the federal investigation into President Trump and Russian interference in the 2016 election. According to an article by my next guest in the Washington Post, the Justice Department is getting ready to close the two-year investigation, and Special Counsel Robert Mueller could issue his final confidential report to the Attorney General any day now. And if that's too long to wait, a preview of it could come by tonight. Paul Manafort, the former chairman of President Trump's 2016 campaign, of course, is nearing the end of his court saga. Prosecutors are set to argue their complete case against Manafort in a sentencing memo due before midnight tonight that could include details that reveal more about Mueller's remaining conclusions. And more is coming in Congress next week as well from Trump's former personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. After a lot of back and forth, it looks like Michael Cohen will testify before a Senate committee on Tuesday, and then in open session, meaning live television and everything, in a House committee on Wednesday. So here to guide us through a mountain of developments surrounding investigations into Trump, the Trump campaign, and Russia is Washington Post correspondent Devlin Barrett. Devlin writes about national security and law enforcement. Devlin, welcome back to WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So how detailed and sweeping is this report expected to be?
You know, I think they will be fairly cautious in the first go-round. I think the first most honest answer is no one really knows how much detail Bob Mueller is going to get into in his report. But there's a two-step process here, and I think the two steps are important. One is Mueller's going to submit a report to his boss, the Attorney General, Bill Barr. And that report is supposed to describe who he charged, which we really already know for the most part, and two, who he investigated but did not charge, and explain why. Now, that part is the most interesting in some ways, and I think there will be a lot of curiosity about that piece of it. But that report to Bill Barr is confidential, meaning it's not supposed to leave the Justice Department. Then Bill Barr has said he wants to reveal as much as possible when he forwards a summary of what Mueller has told him to Congress. And that's, I think, where we're going to get our first understanding of what's in Mueller's report, but it's unclear how much editing Barr is going to do. Barr said he wants to be transparent. He wants to explain as much as possible to the public. But he also said a lot of things that show that he believes that when you don't charge someone, it is standard practice at the Justice Department not to recite chapter and verse of every bad thing you found along the way to not charging someone. And so I think there could be some tussles between Congress and the Justice Department at that point.
On that issue of not revealing to the public things you found along the way to not charging someone, obviously that was a huge issue in 2016 when James Comey, as FBI director, found things to be critical of with respect to Hillary Clinton and her emails, though he didn't charge her. And what he did say publicly was considered so damaging to her election prospects. Would it be fair, is anybody asking Barr, would it be fair to not say what they found with respect to Trump's behavior during the election campaign after Comey said all that about Clinton to such damaging effect?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right. I think that is a huge issue in this as the Justice Department weighs this. And I think most of Barr's body language has been trying to convey that he doesn't want to repeat what Comey did. But I think what's interesting about the current situation is in many ways the roles are reversed now, right? And in many ways it will be House Democrats demanding more information than the Justice Department may be willing to provide. And I think those House Democrats are going to point to the Clinton case and say, look what you did here just 2 years ago. How is it possibly fair or just to not proceed the same way when it's the shoe is on the other foot? And I think that is going to be a big tension point between the two sides. And I do know that among Justice Department officials, there is a very strong desire not to repeat the example of what happened with Clinton and Comey. But, you know, there's political pressure that will be exerted to repeat that example. And I think that, to me, is one of the things I, as a reporter, am looking at most closely and trying to track most closely.
Listeners, we can open the phones for your questions for Devlin Barrett from The Washington Post on the Trump and Russia investigation, with Devlin reporting sources who say the first Mueller report, or the confidential version of it, to the Attorney General could be as soon as days away. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. As you note in your article, Mueller has already charged 34 people with crimes, many of them Russians, and that six Trump associates have already pleaded guilty to Mueller charges. But none of the Americans charged by Mueller are accused of conspiracy with Russia to interfere in the election. So how much can you conclude from that Mueller is heading to a finding of no collusion in any criminal sense?
I think prosecutors build their cases brick by brick, and you know, sometimes they refer to it as each rung of the ladder you have to take on one at a time. And I think if that's true in the Mueller case, I think we are building toward some sort of finding that, look, there was not a grand conspiracy here. Or at least, I should rephrase that, Mueller has not found chargeable evidence of a grand conspiracy here. And so I think that is what's in the public space to date suggests. But I don't think we have the final answer. Part of the reason why the Mueller report is such great interest to everyone is we don't have that final answer, and that's the central question that Mueller was asked to answer, and he still has not directly answered that question. And I think everyone's expectation is that this report will answer that question.
You also wrote that people on Trump's team expect the report to be politically damaging, but not criminally so. What's behind that assumption?
Well, look, I mean, you have to remember that people in Trump's circle don't believe the president committed any crimes, and they're very, you know, wedded to that idea. So you have to, you know, on the first instance, recognize where that perspective is, but then at the same time understand that, you know, a lot of these folks are aware of what people have said in the Mueller grand jury. They're aware of what people have said, White House advisors, et cetera, have said to Mueller's investigators. And they know that there are conversations that have been relayed to the investigators that would be publicly embarrassing to the president and those around him, that would make them not look very good. And so I think there's a significant amount of concern among those folks that they hope, frankly, that Barr and Mueller don't follow the Comey example, because if you were to just sort of describe a bunch of things that, while not adding up to crimes, are damaging, you know, from a political point of view, you know, that's bad for the White House and that's bad for the administration.
Bill in Rego Park, you're on WNYC with Devlin Barrett from The Washington Post. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for having me on. I would like to ask the guest whether there's any reason to believe that the new attorney general is shutting the investigation down.
It's a great question. I have not seen any evidence of that. I think in fact, the reporting that we've been doing all through this time, even before Barr's name became, you know, known as a contender for the attorney general job, is that Mueller and his crew have been working toward this for months, and that, you know, Barr's arrival, more or less, as best we can tell, coincides with Mueller finishing his work. And so I don't have any information that suggests that Barr is making Mueller stop. I think, you know, what's been described to us by a number of folks is that Mueller has been, for the last several months, wrapping up the work.
And nobody knows whether Barr wants to act sort of as Trump's lawyer rather than the justice advocate for the American people when the report to him by Mueller is issued. How much latitude under the special counsel law does Attorney General Barr have to bottle up damaging findings if he wants to act as Trump attorney? And the law is, how specific is the law?
The special counsel regulation is fairly specific in that it says it describes these two steps, but it also gives the Attorney General a fair bit of discretion as to what gets relayed to Congress. And different attorneys general, this special counsel provision is not used very often, but when it has been used, different attorneys general have taken very different approaches to the discretion part. So, for example, the biggest examples of this was Attorney General Janet Reno back in the 90s had a special counsel look at the confrontation at Waco. But when she announced that, she also made clear in her announcement, and I want a lengthy report about this. You know, Rod Rosenstein, when he appointed Bob Mueller, did not make such a specific demand on the special counsel's office. I do think that Mueller is a very, his whole career, he's been a very straight-laced, by-the-book prosecutor. I don't think you should expect something like, for example, the Starr report from Bob Mueller. Like, I would be shocked if that's where this ends up. But I also think Bob Mueller understands there needs to be public credibility behind his findings. So I don't think Bob Mueller, if Bob Mueller's final conclusion is we have charged all the people we are going to charge, we're done here, I don't think Bob Mueller thinks that those two sentences alone are a credible answer. I think Bob Mueller understands that he needs to say more than that. The question is how much more and how much detail does he feel he needs to go into to be credible to the American public.
Robin in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Robin.
Hi. I just haven't heard it framed in this way, that for impeachment, it's not whether or not the president committed a crime. You know, it's not the same situation as even Clinton. What we're weighing is impeachment. And impeachment is whether he did something wrong, if he didn't act in the interest of the country. It's a much different question. And the court provides Congress and the American people with the full information. We're not going to be able to weigh that, and no matter what side you're on. I'm just wondering if that's the consideration in all of this.
I think that's a great point, and I think that is a point that a lot of members of Congress will be making as they want more and are likely to want more answers from Mueller and from Barr on this point. I do think for impeachment, the standard is generally defined as high crimes and misdemeanors. But frankly, I think we have such a small sample set of impeachment in American history that how you define that is up to debate, I guess I would say. And so it is a fair point that, you know, the Justice Department policy is that a sitting president cannot be indicted. I do not expect Bob Mueller to try to change that policy in any way. I think it's an interesting question. I think it'll be part of what fuels what I think will be an interesting tug of war between Congress and the Justice Department after the report comes out. I think it'll be an interesting question how much do Democrats in the House demand more from Mueller on the basis of we need to know exactly what you found in order to decide if we should proceed with any kind of impeachment process.
What do you make of the fact that apparently, Don Jr. has not been interviewed by Mueller's team, despite his central involvement in that June 2016 Trump Tower meeting with Russians. Apparently, Jared Kushner has not been interviewed. Ivanka Trump has not been interviewed. There's one scenario that I've heard, which is that the people who actually don't get interviewed before the end of the investigation are the people who are going to be indicted, because you don't interview targets, you interview subjects and witnesses. How much stock do you put in that?
I put a lot of stock in that. I think that is a good description of the general practice of investigations, is that if you are going to interview a target of an investigation, that interview would happen at the very end or not at all. And I think that is an absolutely correct frame to think about some of these things. However, I'll point out a couple of things. Jared Kushner was interviewed on a limited number of topics related to Mike Flynn, the former national security advisor. And it's true, as far as we know, Donald Trump Jr. has not been interviewed. And I do think those are important data points as we look at this. However, I also think it's important to recognize some other data points, which is that as much as they have looked at this, there has been no, there has been no grand jury activity that we know of since Roger Stone's indictment, which was about a month ago. There has been none of this sort of observable investigative work around folks like Kushner and Donald Trump Jr. in quite some time. All of those things, I think, are suggestive, not definitive. I wouldn't argue definitive for either side. But all those things are suggestive that the investigative work on there is not ramping up.
Devlin Barrett, Washington Post correspondent, with us on developments in the Trump investigation by Robert Mueller. Devlin, I know you didn't write the story today about Trump campaign advisor Roger Stone, who you're just talking about, his day in court, his day in court yesterday. But you are a national security reporter, so I wonder how much your brain is exploding over the fact that Stone admitted to posting a picture on Instagram of the judge hearing his case with a picture of crosshairs. The result was that she put a gag order on him, stopping him from talking to the press about his case so as not to bias a potential juror pool. But my God, how numb have we become? How much have we normalized Trump world authoritarianism, I can call it that, I think, and threats of violence that Stone isn't being charged, you know, with something like incitement to terrorism, especially with him posting the judge with crosshairs right as that Coast Guard officer was charged with plotting to assassinate Nancy Pelosi and other Democratic politicians and CNN and MSNBC hosts. Why is a gag order the only response to what could easily be seen as Stone's incitement to violence?
Well, a couple things. One, I completely agree with you. That was a wild hearing yesterday. And, you know, there are I started covering federal courts, you know, more than 20 years ago. I've never quite seen a hearing in an issue quite like that before. Two, I take your point that it's alarming and might generate, you know, a judge deciding to put someone in jail as opposed to leave them out on bond. But we already have a track record with this particular judge who's handled, for example, the Manafort case as well. And she gave essentially Paul Manafort two strikes. She said, you know, Paul Manafort violated the terms of his bail, and she gave him basically a warning and said, look, you get one more shot at this, and there won't be another one after that. So Manafort was on the two-strike rule. And then, amazingly, Manafort was charged with additional crimes while he was out on bail, so he actually ended up going to jail because he had, you know, gotten his second strike. It was very clear in the courtroom yesterday that she was giving Roger Stone, you know, again, one more chance, and then that would be his second strike. And she said to him, you won't get a third strike here. Second strike, you're going back. You're going in jail. And it is wild. It is crazy. It is bizarre behavior. And it's so, I mean, part of what's amazing about it to me is Roger Stone needs to make money. And this may have been a very poorly thought out attempt to raise more money for his legal defense. But it's so self-destructive. Ask any lawyer and they'll tell you this is the worst possible thing you can do because this judge holds your fate in her hand and now you're going to do something that is a kind of threat to her. How do you think that's going to turn out for you?
Right.
Any lawyer would give that advice. And it is amazing. It's just amazing.
And it's not only on the judge, as I'm thinking of it. Would a prosecutor step in and look at that posting? I mean, could you imagine if a rapper who's already accused of a crime did that to their judge, or if Pelosi had done it, or almost anyone outside of Trump world?
Right. Look, I think that it's unquestionably right on the line of just being a threat, and I think people can interpret it different ways. Stone's defense of himself, for what it's worth, is he realized it was wrong after he'd posted it, and he didn't realize there was a target in the picture when he posted it, and he thought the target image was a Celtic cross.
Is that true?
I will leave.
Oh, that's his claim?
That's his claim. I will leave it to, you know, listeners as to whether they believe those claims or not. But that was what he said to the judge yesterday in his defense. And so I think faced with that, I mean, look, I think as self-destructive as that behavior is, I wasn't that surprised that the judge decided not to throw him in jail. I was a little surprised that Roger Stone went on the witness stand and basically made his situation a little worse by saying things that the judge clearly did not believe. And, you know, I think he made it more of a toss-up proposition than it was going in. But he lives another day. I mean, there's a lot of folks who think, you know, given the way Stone has behaved all through his life, it will be difficult for him to live up to the terms of his bail.
Dee in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Devlin Barrett covering the Trump investigation for The Washington Post. Hi, Dee.
Hi there. Thank you both. A very interesting topic. So I'm wondering, in any scenario, if Mueller could leave behind indictments for Don Jr. And or Donald Trump under a sealed indictment that's not opened until after 2020.
You mean after Donald Trump is presumably out of office?
Right.
I think it's is that technically possible? Yes, I don't think there is much rational reason to expect that. One, that would fly in the face of, I think, everything I understand over the years to be how Bob Mueller works. I don't think he would, you know, be that creative in the system. Like, Bob Mueller is a very respected, very hardworking, essentially career federal prosecutor and who became the FBI director. He is not a person who gets creative with the law or regulations as a general rule. So to do something like that, I think, would be incredibly out of character for him. And so I would be very surprised if that's the direction this goes in.
Mithra in Middletown. You're on WNYC. Hello, Mithra.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my question. I'm curious about the what's known about the timing of Rod Rosenstein's resignation and stepping away from the investigation. It seems odd to me that he's been in charge of it for so long, only to step down just before the report is released.
That's a great point. I think the way I think of it is this. The latest we've heard on Rosenstein's intentions is that he plans to leave probably mid-March. And I think there is a point of view within the Justice Department leadership that it would be ideal for the report to come while Barr is the Attorney General and Rod is the Deputy Attorney General, because I think that would give, there's a view that that would give the Justice Department maximum credibility for any announcements it has to make. Part of the reason why I wrote the story I did the other day is because I think we are in the window of time between right now and, you know, the first 2 weeks of March, when a lot of folks in the Justice Department believe would be the best time to produce the Mueller report, because Rod and Barr are both there. And I think that's the ideal. Look, prosecution schedules change. You know, they slip in part because they are essentially private deadlines, not public deadlines. But I think there's a lot of thought within the Justice Department that it would be best, if possible, to release this report while Rod is still in the job.
What do you make of Jeffrey Rosen being tapped to replace Rod Rosenstein as Deputy Attorney General? Some of our listeners may know Jeffrey Rosen has been a legal commentator in the media. He's been on this show multiple times. He's the head of the Constitution Center in Philadelphia. He has uttered a conservative thought from time to time, but certainly not only that. I think he was out front early, if I remember, supporting Trump's first Supreme Court nominee. But what do you make of Jeffrey Rosen being tapped for that position?
So two things. One, I think Jeffrey Rosen is definitely Bill Barr's pick. I think the Attorney General, our understanding is that one of Bill Barr's conditions for taking the Attorney General job was that he would get to pick his deputy. So I think Jeffrey Rosen is Bill Barr's pick. And that's important because there has been a lot of internal strife inside the Justice Department during the Trump administration between the top people in the top two jobs. And I think part of the reason for Barr wanting Rosen is he thinks he will have a good working relationship with Rosen.
Let me jump in. I'm being told that I may be confused, so I want to correct this as quickly as possible if I am. Is this not the same Jeffrey Rosen I was referring to? This might be a different Jeffrey Rosen than the one from the Constitution Center. Do you know?
Oh, okay. I think it is a different Jeffrey Rosen. I think the Jeffrey Rosen who has been nominated to be the Deputy Attorney General is a longtime private lawyer at Kirkland, a law firm, and is currently working as the Deputy Secretary of Transportation.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So I think we're talking about two different Jeffrey Rosens.
Okay, good. I'm glad we cleared that up, because I was thinking, Deputy Attorney General, that's just the kind of thing that the Jeffrey Rosen I know comments on all the time.
Sure.
So now we know there are many Jeffrey Rosens in the world, and there are at least two who who entered this conversation.
Right.
So my apologies and my correction issued to both Jeffrey Rosens and to all our listeners.
All the Jeffrey Rosens.
Before you go, quickly about Michael Cohen. He will testify before some members of Congress next week. What can he say or can't he say about Russia and Trump in particular? I gather there are limits.
Yeah, so we're told that he is not going to be talking about the Russia investigation, but that he is going to be talking about Trump campaign finance issues, his relationship with Trump, things that Trump has said to him over the years. So I think lawmakers will probably try to get a backdoor question or two on Russia to him. I would be surprised if he takes that bait. But I think part of what's most interesting about Cohen testifying is besides just what he might say about the president, it's an incredibly risky thing for him to do. He has already pled guilty to lying to Congress. He is a person who has a, let's call it tricky track record with the truth. And now, just as he's heading to prison, he's going to be under hours of public questioning in which he's going to have to be very, very careful not to tell any falsehoods. And in the past, that has proven difficult for Michael Cohen. And so, to me, I'm a little surprised that his lawyers are going forward with this, because I think it is very risky for him. And I think people will be looking for a lot of, salacious details about Trump, and that's obviously important. But I also think, from a legal perspective, boy, is it risky, super risky.
They keep scheduling it and then finding one reason or another to back out. Any reason to think that won't happen again?
I think it's certainly possible, given the track record, right? But I think that the committee has tried really hard at this point to absolutely lock him in precisely because of that. But look, I think predicting Michael Cohen's future behavior is a tricky bet.
But I wonder then if, we shouldn't anticipate too much news coming out of that hearing or those hearings, if there's more than one, that we don't already know about.
It's funny. His lawyer has been hyping up this hearing as, it's going to be incredibly newsworthy. I don't quite understand the strategy there, because that puts more pressure on his own client. But he knows more than I do of what's in Michael Cohen's head, so maybe he's right. Maybe it's worth hyping up. I'll just say I'm cautiously skeptical of how this is all going to go down.
And last thing, I see you have a story today about a government worker accused of leaking information about Michael Cohen's finances to Stormy Daniels' lawyer, Michael Avenatti, who then made it public when he was in that lawsuit involving Cohen and Trump. Who allegedly leaked what, and where does this fit into the larger picture of anything?
So this is about something called suspicious activity reports, and those are reports that banks generate and give to the government. They don't necessarily mean anyone's committed a crime. It's just a way for a bank to say to the government, hey, this may be something you want to look at and see if there's something nefarious going on here. And what happened was last year, according to federal prosecutors, an IRS analyst in San Francisco decided to give these documents about Michael Cohen transactions to Michael Avenatti, and then they became public. And those documents, sharing those documents outside of the government is a crime. It's pretty straightforward in the law that you're not supposed to do that. And so the transactions themselves, some of them became the basis for his criminal charge. So those are, important transactions in the greater scheme of things. But it's another case where we've seen someone inside the government so alarmed by something they came across related to someone close to Trump that they decided to, according to federal prosecutors, take a risk and share that information with the public. And I think that has been that has occurred more than a few times since this all began.
Devlin Barrett writes about national security and law enforcement for The Washington Post. Devlin, thank you so much for filling us in on the latest regarding the Trump World investigations. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.